Love of poetry isn't what you usually think would bring four guys together, but that's how it started in 2006 for these men, whose ages range from early 20s to late 40s. Here's poet and playwright John Murillo.
We all met at Cave Canem, the summer workshop retreat for African American poets, and we got along pretty well and noticed one of the things we had in common was a love and reverence for the work of the poet Etheridge Knight. And we came together, formed a group, and started doing readings.
And that was the birth of the symphony, which played an integral role in the development of their individual works. Stay with us to hear how poetry changed and influenced the lives of John Murillo, Reginald Duane Betts, Marcus Jackson, and Randall Horton. Today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. The four men who made up the symphony originated from different parts of the country, California, Maryland, Ohio, and Alabama, but they all write poetry that reflects the black male experience. Poems about love, family, urban life, prison, redemption, and responsibility. Interested in craft, they came together for readings and appearances at colleges and public schools across the country, including Paseo High School in Kansas City, when they visited as part of Park University's 2011 Ethnic Voices Poetry Series. They shared their love for the work of a poet they never met, the late Etheridge Knight, one of the major poets of the Black Arts Movement. Though he died in 1991, Knight's work, beginning with his first book in 1968, Poems from Prison, still touches readers today. Again, here's Symphony founder John Murillo.
What we do is we try to pay homage to Etheridge. We read some of his work, comment on it, and we do our own work as well. The symphony, we get our name from a classic late 80s hip-hop song that was kind of an all-star group of the rappers at the time, Big Daddy Kane, Kool G Rap, Craig G, Master Ace. And we all consider ourselves very strong or becoming strong. They're strong. I'm trying to get strong. Poets who come together, you know, to form around this nucleus we call the symphony. And we've been all over the country at this point, giving readings, teaching workshops, do a lot of work in communities.
That's one of the things that's really great about that we get a chance to give back. And we've done things in juvenile detention centers, community workshops.
That's Randall Horton speaking.
And it's also a way for us to get together as poets and leave all of the other stuff behind and remember why we started. And it was just the love of the words and how words made us come alive in some kind of way and was integral in our well-being. So it's a lot of things. Yeah.
Well, I know, Randall, you spent a little time in prison. Is that right?
That's
and
correct.
I know Etheridge Knight did, too.
Well, we all come to Etheridge from a different place. And I know for myself, it is because when I was in prison, I began to write. And when I got out, I began to read more literature. And I was looking for the things that had talked about some of my experiences. And I didn't see that until one day. I remember very distinctly, I was in this workshop at Howard University. And the poet Tony Medina gave me this book. And he had a whole bunch of books in it. He had everyone in the class sort of read a poem. And he gave me a poem by Etheridge Knight, who I had never heard of. And I read the poem, and I was like, who is this guy? So I went back, and I did some research, and I got his books. And that just started my love affair with Etheridge from that moment on. And he came from the same place I came from, and he was able to transcend that into something else. And I was always fascinated by that, yeah.
And that's what you attempt to do in your work as well, I believe.
Right, yeah, no doubt. And I had to talk, and I was looking for a way to talk about some of these things, and so yeah, I mean, Etheridge laid that blueprint for me to talk about those things as well. Yeah.
Duane Betts is also here with us. Duane, you have written a very gripping book, Shahid Reads His Own Poem.
Yes.
And the entire book really is about the prison experience. So did you discover Etheridge there, or did you discover Etheridge Knight somewhere else?
Well, it's sort of an interesting story. I think I was in solitary confinement for some foolishness or another. And in solitary confinement, you couldn't request books, but the other convicts, inmates, what have you, who were locked up around you, you could just yell out on the door and ask for a book. And somebody slid The Black Poets, edited by Dudley Randall, under my door. And I mean, I never knew who slid it under my door, but that was my first exposure to Robert Hayden, Gwendolyn Brooks, Etheridge Knight, Sonya Sanchez. And the thing that pulled me in about Etheridge Knight was he made me recognize that poetry, in a way, was a chronicling of history of the time of the poet. The poem in particular that said something to me, because I got tried as an adult and sent to prison as an adult, and I was, you know, 5'5", 125 pounds.
And only 16 years old.
And I was only 16. You know, and given that I had carjacked somebody, I sort of understood that there would be huge ramifications for my mistake, but I just didn't expect to be placed where I was. And Etheridge had a poem called For Freckle-Faced Gerald, and in that poem he talks about a kid who was under 18 who was sent to prison too, and that made me realize that poetry could both speak to experiences that I recognize, but speak to experiences that you just don't expect to find in a poem, and in a way chronicle history in a manner that's sometimes left out of the history books. At that moment, I decided to be a poet, essentially because I realized that the art, what poetry could do, is something that you can't find anywhere else. And as a 16-year-old, 15-year-old, 14-year-old, trying to find a way to express myself in the world and figure out what was going on, not even that I had to be a poet at that time, but I just had no access to art. And then finally, when I got access to it, it's just that I realized that that's what I wanted to do. And so, you know, for me, the symphony and us going around reading and talking to kids and teaching writing to children and reading in different places, it's my opportunity to not only to be a writer, but to spread the word. One of the reasons why I appreciate the four of us coming together is it's one of those things where we actually do set egos aside. And the thing that becomes important is the work. And it's not necessarily about making money. It's not about getting famous. It literally is about finding a place and a space and an opportunity to read to a crowd of people who want to hear good work.
Oh, that's Dwayne Betts. And this is New Letters on the Air. And I've got a very special episode today because I'm featuring the four poets in a group called The Symphony: Reginald Dwayne Betts, Marcus Jackson, Randall Horton, and John Murillo. So what was the point where you all four realized that Etheridge Knight was this linchpin for the four of you that brought you together? You were at Cave Canem, and what happened?
John, Dwayne, and I, this is Marcus, by the way, in case anybody was getting mixed up on who's talking. Our first year at Cave Canem in 2006, we were roommates, and we just got to talking after a couple days about poets that we loved. And instantly, one of the first two or three names that we all said was Etheridge. I mean, the bond started really, really quickly with the three of us. And Randall was there, too, mm-hmm. on his first retreat.
Right.
It felt like you were meeting family or cousins that you hadn't seen since you were 5 or 6. But somehow, we had replicated experiences that we could build our own understanding of the world off of just hearing each other's.
So when you perform together, do you perform the works of Etheridge Knight, or do you read your own poems that reverberate his work?
Yeah, we do both. We usually start with a round robin where we're reading one poem of Etheridge's apiece, and then we'll read our own work and maybe say a few words about how those particular pieces that we read speak to our own aesthetic. And each of us, again, like Randall was saying, we each come to Etheridge for different reasons. He feeds us in different ways. So we start that conversation. What we try to do is to give a reading, but it's also a conversation among brothers in front of a group of people. And then we try to involve the audience in that conversation, too.
And then you got to understand, ultimately, that it's a reclamation project. The real tragedy is that even among writers, you could be somebody who everybody loves and few people talk about. And so when we say that it's a reclamation project, I think that it was just a conscious decision on our part to say, listen, we come to writing, and we don't come to writing just to promote our own work. We don't come to writing just to acknowledge our work. Really, we come to writing like at Cave Canem. We would be outside drinking water in front of the dorm rooms.
Water.
and talking about poets that we love. But see, what happens is, especially with young people don't understand often that when you see me up reading my poetry, that it's a legacy that I'm bringing to the stage with me. So when I say that it's a reclamation project, I say that it's our opportunity to tell the world Etheridge Knight is a large part of the legacy that we bring when we read our words to people.
That's Dwayne Betts. Dwayne, you're saying that made me think of an exercise that you did with Elizabeth Alexander at your very first Cave Canem. That's what it says in here anyway, so...
No, it was. I was wondering how you knew that.
Yeah, it was.
I thought you were psychic for a minute.
I would bet that all of us have a poem in there that we'd probably did from a copy column. I know I do. Do you have
one? Oh, yeah, my book has a few.
See. That's where the title poem came from.
Exactly. Well, why don't we have you read that title poem?
Okay, cool. Shahid reads his own poem. I come from the cracked hands of men who use the smoldering and the blunts to blow shotguns. Men who arrange their lives around the mystery of the moon breaking a street corner in half. I come from Swan Road written in a child's slanted block letters across a playground fence. The orange glow with black stripes and Bishop's left hand untethered and rolling to the sideline. A crowd open mouth, waiting to see the end of the sweetest crossover in a Virginia State pen. I come from Friday night's humid and musty air, junkyard band cranking in a stolen Bonneville, a tilted bottle of Wild Irish Rose against my lips, and King Headley's secret written in the lines of my palm. I come from beneath a cloud of white smoke, a lit pipe, and the way glass heats rocks into a piece of heaven, from the weight of nothing in my palm, a bullet and an unfired snub-nosed revolver, and every day the small muscles in my finger threaten to pull a trigger, slight and curved like my woman's eyelashes.
That's beautiful. That's Shahid Reads His Own Palm, and that's the title poem of a book by Reginald Dwayne Betts. And this is New Letters on the Air. When you wrote your introduction to the book, you thanked Elizabeth Alexander for making you think about a long line that you come from, basically. So did the poem grow out of that moment, or was it a poem you were working on before?
No, the poem actually grew out of that moment. But it's not that I hadn't been thinking of these people before, but it's just the same thing about the idea that this is a reclamation project. A lot of times you have things germinating in your head that you just need the opportunity to put it on a page. And so when she said that, in some ways it was devastating because, you know, you start thinking about your history, then you start trying to parse out your history. And sometimes when you think of it, you just think of the negative things. And so the poem was sort of my attempt to go back to small moments that I remember, like as a kid writing Swan Road on a playground fence, and then go back to other moments. Like the best basketball player I've ever seen in my life is in a state penitentiary. He was 6'1 and could shoot from 35 feet out and could dunk on anybody. And so in the poem, I try to talk about him too. And then the last line is, moments my fingers threaten to pull a trigger slight and curve like my woman's eyelashes. And so it's this thing where everything comes together. The references to August Wilson, the references to basketball, the references to men who I came from, all of it comes together in sort of a way where I'm trying to just acknowledge in a small way that history that birthed me.
And who wants to follow that and throw down the gauntlet? Who's going to step up next?
Marcus.
Yeah, I was going to say Marcus.
Why Marcus? Just to volunteer him? Or...
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I love Marcus's work.
Aw. I'll read a piece that mainly came out of realizing how thankful and extraordinary not only being able to go to college is, but being able to go to college for free is. And I wanted to write a poem specifically to financial aid. for those of us lucky enough, and for those of us who worked hard enough, it's called Ode to the Scholarship. You placate the stringent landlord of the registrar. Your twinkling tweezers pluck tuition's thousands of thick splinters. You give us a new room, sweet mates who doze too late, whose towels hang dank. You heap our trays with cafeteria calories, nozzled ice cream we spoon until the bowl bottom clanks. We clawed like trapped hawks to win you. We read our retinas ragged, studied and notated until the library's lights died like gasless lanterns. We triple-checked every speck your applications incorporate. We whispered prayers and fed fat envelopes to mail drops' mysterious mouths. Of course, the ducted salt of tears upon the letter confirming you. Of course, our mamas shrieked to Jesus. Of course, local papers ran features with our pictures. Scholarship, think of the places you diverted us from. Night corners at our birth block's verges, police caprices locked back seats, motel rooms with dented lampshades, towns where bone, muscle, and flesh best most of the hidden electricity our minds fight to emit.
That's Marcus Jackson. Is that, this a newer work?
That is from my debut collection, Neighborhood Register, by Coven Carey Press.
That's another thing that you all four share, is that you've had the opportunity to go to college, and now you're teaching and giving back in some ways. Randall, can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I never thought that was in my future. And then, of course, getting incarcerated with 7 felony convictions, one would think that one would never be able to do anything meaningful. But it's funny that I visualized that, though. I probably didn't have the right to, but I understood that once I began to write that something was going to happen in my life. I couldn't explain it. I couldn't put my hand on it. But I knew if I just followed what I really wanted to do in life, because after so many years of not really knowing, this was the only thing that made sense. I can remember being in my prison cell ordering catalog books from colleges, looking to see what the programs were. I understood that education and knowledge was going to be instrumental into how I navigate the world from here on out.
I couldn't help but think of that one poem that's in your book, The Lingua Franca of Ninth Street, called My Class at Chicago State University's Program for High School Kids.
Right, yeah.
That's probably not a poem you were thinking about reading, but...
No, I read it.
I love what it has to say about poetry, too.
Well, it has something to say about poetry, and it's interesting because it talks about being in the classroom and not necessarily having any young boys in there, which is a tragedy as well. Okay. My class at Chicago State University's program for high school kids, after Patricia Smith. In a summer enrichment program on the South Side, I have a class of bubbly 13-year-old girls. 2 weeks we have argued if poetry is hip-hop, until finally I exercise this misunderstood concept. And today, I have placed metaphor on their fingertips, presented lyrical landscapes of urban experiences mirroring their own. And not one believed poetry could do this. They told me, "We thought poetry was a bunch of bull, you know, like making people fall asleep and whatnot." This declaration comes with stringent poker faces, the concept foreign as to how a poet can capture emotion inside the black oil glow of a Gaston Glock, or the way a girl double-dutches while her barrettes dance like fireflies under a street lamp. And yet today is a breakthrough. Except there are no young boys in the classroom to share in accepting how literature is a reflection of ourselves. I concede this footnote for now and use my felonious past as an entranceway into their world of street gangs, shootings, teenage pregnancy, absentee fathers, mothers strung out on drugs, and it is only because I walk and talk like I've seen their world through a magnifying glass am I privileged to confessionals about their lives. For workshop, they pick an anthology poem written by a woman about child abuse. "Yo, we got a rap about this one, Mr. Horton." Soon, the conversation switches direction in mid-sentence. The girls tell me how they know someone who shares this burden, as if an image can emerge out of their gut about being fondled or violated by an uncle or stepbrother. I challenge each one to drape themselves in this person who cries a cataract of shame. Pick up your pens. Use them as a voice to say something, to cut to the truth of things, to discover your own demons. I tell them this. What comes from this purging is between us. Let's just say a weaker person would run from their truth. The room becomes quiet. A miracle takes place. A language shapes itself, their language. Voices float above silence. I open my journal to join the cleansing.
My Class at Chicago State University's Program for High School Kids by Randall Horton. That's in his book, The Lingua Franca of Night Street. This is New Letters on the Air. And I'm talking today with the symphony, four poets, Duane Betts, Marcus Jackson, Randall Horton, and John Murillo. You know, when you were talking about college, anybody here ever think that that wasn't in your future?
You went to school in L.A. first, right, John? College?
No. Oh, yeah. Community college. I graduated high school with a remedial degree, basically. All the classes I was taking were remedial, so I had to go to community college for a few years to learn what I should have done in high school. So I essentially transferred as a 22-year-old freshman to Howard.
So why were you in remedial classes?
I was dumb. No, I'm just joking.
I had a jump shot, you know.
I think maybe some of the administrators and maybe some teachers had low expectations. I was an athlete in high school as a basketball player, not even a particularly gifted basketball player, but, you know, a basketball player nonetheless. So we were given these classes, human relations, a class called U, Y-O-U is the title of the class. With basketball and football players. And we learn about you. What's your favorite food? Spaghetti, you get an A. So classes keep us eligible. Up to my senior year in high school, I was still being taught that a verb was an action word, that a noun was a person, place, thing, or idea. And I just thought school was boring. And it wasn't until the second semester of my senior year where a teacher saw me in her class and wondered, why are you in this class? And she put me in her college prep class, and I got in there, and the other students were actually reading books. The first book I remember reading was Wuthering Heights, and they were discussing the books, and that's where I should have been all along. But it was late, so I ended up having to do the community college route. And, you know, it was there where I really discovered a love of literature. You know, I thought I was going to be an essayist, so I was reading James Baldwin, Eldridge Cleaver, people like that, Frantz Fanon. So I'm pretty grateful for the time that I did spend in community college. And I think that had I gone to Howard at 18, I don't think I would have gotten much work done. You know, I needed to have some of those days behind me.
Like, I went to community college, too. And I even remember Kari Conlon. It was me, you, and Jamal. And it was one of the things that bonded me with him and this other friend of ours named Jamal May was that, you know, we weren't the traditional students. Like, I was first-generation convict. I don't think anybody ever says that. but I was also, you know, first-generation college student. But the thing about it, you know, like when we go in front of an audience, they see, well, except Marcus, because Marcus graduated magna cum laude. But, but you know, they see the four of us coming together. It's sort of like late-blooming, realized potential. But that's not what they see. They see award-winning poets. They see people who write good work, who teach at universities. And they don't understand often the struggle that it took to get to that point. And right. I think that's why one of the things that was a common presence for me at Kaveh Condom that allowed me not to be drowned in all of the intellectual talk was, you know, you had cats like Marcus that was down to earth, but then you had somebody like Randall who'd been through similar situations, not academically, but like life experience-wise. And then you had John, and particularly like John and Jamal, who took the same type of academic path. And I don't know, I think when we do this, people look at us and say, okay, this is a different face. In a way, it's empowering to go in front of like a group of high school kids, a group of middle school kids. For every time we go in front of a group of kids and they talk, they say the black father's not here and the black father's not there. You know, I don't know my daddy. And I think that we actually do put somewhat of a different face on what it's like to be, you know, a black man in this particular century and living in this particular time in these places.
I would imagine that you have some real impact. That was Duane Betts talking, and we were talking with John Murillo right before that. Now, John, you've got some playwriting in your background. Is that right?
A little bit.
Does that add to what you guys do as a group?
Not yet. We won't work on it. Working on it.
Duane has some good ideas of some collaborative pieces where maybe we're even dramatizing some of Etheridge's work. So that may come into play at some point.
I like that idea. I think that would be exciting to see that. Well, John, do you have a poem you'd like to share with us?
Sure. So Duane said that the guy in the prison was the best basketball player he'd ever seen because he had not seen me play. So I have to, you know, forgive that one. Back in the day, you know, when I was younger, we all used to think that we were going to be NBA stars. Here's a poem called Practicing Fadeaways. Only one thing I need to explain. I mentioned Grambling in the poem, and that's Grambling University, which is a historically black college in New Orleans. Practicing fadeaways. On a deserted playground in late day sun, my palms dusted black, dribbling a worn leather ball behind my back. This loneliness echoes from the handball courts nearby. Nearly all the markings, free throw lane, sideline, center circle, rub to nothing. A crack in the earth cuts across the schoolyard, jagged as a scar on a choir boy's cheek. 20 years ago, I ran this very court with 9 other wannabe ballers. We'd steal through peeled chain links or hop the gate to get here, our blacktop Eden. One boy, who had a funny pigeon-toed set shot and a voice full of church bells, sang spirituals every time he made a basket. The other boys humming along, laughing, high fives flying down the court. And a boy we called the Sandman, for how he put you to sleep with his shoulder fake a drop step, over 6 feet tall in the 10th grade, smooth talker with an itch for older guys' girlfriends. One Sunday morning, they found him stabbed to death outside the Motel 6, pockets untouched, bills folded neatly against his beautiful, cooling thigh. And downtown Ricky Brown, whose family headed west when he was 2 but still called himself a New Yorker, who never pulled from less than 30 feet out and could bank shots blindfolded. He went to Grambling, drove himself crazy with conspiracy theories and liquor, was last seen roaming the French Quarter, shoeless, babbling about the Illuminati's 666 ways to enslave the populace. At 16, I discovered Venice Beach, with its 1,000 bodybuilders, roller skates, and red thong bikinis. I would stand on the sidelines and watch the local ball players leaping and hollering quicksilver giants run and gun, already grown into their man bodies, funkadelic rising from a boombox in the sand. Now, all I hear are chain nets chiming as I sink one fadeaway after another, the backboard, the pole, throwing a long shadow across the cracked black asphalt. What the nets want must be this caress, this stillness stretching along every avenue, over high school gymnasiums and deserted playgrounds, and the ambulance drivers drifting into naps back at the station house. What the boys who ran these courts wanted was a lob pass, high enough to pull them into the sky, something they could catch in both hands and hang from, long enough for someone to snap a photograph, to hold them there, skybound, risen.
Practicing Fadeaways by John Murillo from his 2010 book, Up Jump the Boogie. The other three from the symphony who visited Kansas City as part of Park University's 2011 Ethnic Voices Poetry Series were Randall Horton, Marcus Jackson, and Reginald Dwayne Betts. Though there are no signs of recent performances together, more books have been published. Find links to their works and what they're up to now on our website, newletters.org. Click on the air to search the symphony. While you're there, sign up for our free weekly podcast under Ways to Listen, or find us on iTunes. You can follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at New Letters Radio. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Partial financial support comes from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was recorded by Jason Scheifler and originally produced with Annie Walsh, Luke Steelman, and Dennis Conroe. Thanks also to Renita Johnson, Danny Moran, Cassie Vaughn, and Jamie Walsh. And thank you for listening to New Letters on the Air. I'm Angela Elam.